Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Speculation is mounting about potential vice presidential candidates as the national political conventions near. We have in St. Louis one of the foremost experts on the vice presidency, St. Louis University law professor Joel Goldstein. He's written a book titled The White House Vice Presidency, The Path to Significance from Mondale to Biden. He makes the point that the last six vice presidents have played a different kind of role than their predecessors. Whether that continues remains, of course, to be seen. Joel Goldstein joins us by phone. Joel, nice to talk to you again.
Thanks very much for having me, Don.
Well, let's get right with it. There's so much discussion about the vice presidential potential here, and we'll talk specifically about that in a moment. But let me ask first, have the criteria for selecting vice presidential candidates changed in the more recent cycles?
I think it's become increasingly important that vice presidential candidates be presidential, that they be somebody who reachable voters for each ticket would perceive as somebody who they could see sitting in the Oval Office if that happened. And so I think the most important factor really is whether or not somebody is equipped and perceived as able to be president, and then whether they can pass a vetting screen so that there's nothing in their background that embarrasses the ticket. There are other factors that are considered, but those are the sort of the threshold requirements.
But has that always been the case? I mean, the vice president, that is his principal role is to be available if the president is incapacitated.
Well, for most of our history, vice presidential candidates were chosen by party leaders, not by the presidential candidates. They often were put on the ticket to bring the party together, to balance the ticket ideologically. The importance of the successor role really emerged primarily in the post-World War II, the beginning of the nuclear age, when succession really became something that was focused on. In the more recent times, the vice presidency has become a job not focused so much on succession, but on focused on being a integral part of the president's inner circle and being a operator who functions on an ongoing basis during the president's term, not simply once it prematurely ends.
I've forgotten the number. You have it, of course, in your book. The number of vice presidents who have actually assumed office on the death or incapacitation of a president.
Well, there have been nine vice presidents who succeeded to the presidency after the death. In one case, the resignation, of course, of President Nixon, but so there are nine who succeeded. There have been a number of presidential incapacities, although generally speaking, they haven't been recognized and no temporary succession took place.
I want to get into that a little bit later because there's some fascinating material there. But before we move on to certain specifics about the book, do you think the criteria for vice president this time might be a little different given the personalities of the presumptive candidates?
Well, I think that Mr. Trump and Secretary Clinton have different challenges. Mr. Trump is sort of the consummate outsider. He's the first presumptive nominee since 1940, never to have held governmental office. And so one would think that he would choose somebody who's experienced in politics. He also doesn't have any sort of ostensible national security credential, and one would think he might look in that direction. Secretary Clinton, by contrast, really is somebody of wide experience in the executive branch and the Senate, the Secretary of State. She doesn't have quite the same needs. But I would think that she would look for somebody who's presidential. I guess another challenge that Mr. Trump has is that a number of the people who would normally be viewed as some among the most likely or most attractive vice presidential candidates have gone pretty far to indicate that they're not interested in assuming that role on his ticket. So his pool may be a little bit shallower than is normally the case.
I think Condoleezza Rice, just in the very recent past, has turned him down from what I see in the news reports.
Well, that's right. And Governor Kasich has gone pretty far in that direction. Senator Rubio, who looks like he's going to run for re-election to the Senate in Florida, has indicated he's not interested. After the State of the Union, when Governor Nikki Haley gave the Republican response, she was talked about as a sure shortlister, but she's indicated she's not interested. Governor Susana Martinez of New Mexico, even Governor Scott of Florida, who was one of Mr. Trump's early supporters, has indicated he's not interested. So there have been a number of people who've gone pretty far to take themselves out, and that gives him a smaller pool than is normally the case.
Well, let me just interject some personal opinion here and get your reaction to it. With regard to Donald Trump, I would think he would not want anybody that's going to be a contrarian to anything he says. He takes charge. He's running his campaign. I don't think he wants to hear from anybody else on anything.
Well, I mean, if there is that perception, and particularly among prospective running mates, that's a problem. That will be a problem. I mean, the being vice president is really like a political marriage with no possibility of divorce. And how the experience is, both during the campaign and during the election, depends upon whether or not the presidential candidate or president is somebody who invites views and dissenting views or not. Our last six presidents have been pretty good about hearing their vice presidents, even when they were saying things that they disagreed with. And that's crucial to making the role meaningful. But if somebody doesn't have that disposition, it minimizes the role.
That, of course, is what your book is about, and I want to talk about that after my second injection of personal opinion, and that being Elizabeth Warren has no chance of being a vice presidential candidate, even if she wanted it, because I would think that Hillary Clinton wants to make history by herself.
Well, I think that that's certainly possible. I mean, the argument for Senator Warren would be that she would be a way to energize, to engage the supporters of Senator Sanders. She's obviously a very forceful spokesperson. If Secretary Clinton chose a woman, it would be a way of suggesting that she's a bold, creative political leader. In a way that perhaps some people don't think of her as being. I mean, on the other hand, of course, the irony is that our presidential tickets have generally not had gender balance, so people suggesting that there needs to be gender balance on the ticket, that's a relatively new idea. We've only had gender balance two times in 57 presidential elections. But it would seem likely that the first woman presidential candidate and first woman president, if it turns out that way, that would be historic in itself. And I tend to think that usually the concern that a running mate would overshadow the presidential candidate or a vice president overshadowing a president, it's not going to happen that way. The focus on the president and the presidential candidates is so much greater that they're bound to overshadow their running mates.
Do you want to take out your crystal ball?
Well, the danger of taking out a crystal ball is that then people can question your expertise. So I really don't. I mean, one of the challenges is that the candidates probably won't make their selection for about another month, and the context can change a lot during that time. And also the vetting materials can disclose things that those of us on the outside simply aren't aware of. So it's very difficult from the outside to make a prediction. It wouldn't surprise me if Secretary Clinton's choice is somebody like Senator Kaine or Senator Warner from Virginia, but. If it was somebody else, it wouldn't necessarily surprise me either.
It's almost an unfair question, but I had to ask it, Joe. Okay, let's talk about the book. You've already alluded to how things have changed during the last the last 40 years or so. The key to it all is included in the title of your book called The White House Vice Presidency. And that changed with Walter Mondale. Why Walter Mondale, President Carter's vice president?
Well, Mondale and the people around him really studied the history of the office. And while the office had risen a lot during the quarter century or so, beginning with the vice presidency of Richard Nixon, it also had remained a very frustrating and limited position. And they really looked at what were the problems that Hubert Humphrey, that Nelson Rockefeller, that other vice presidents had, and then they tried to avoid them. And what Mondale came up with was a different vision of the office, whereas his predecessors had always tried to get some part of the government, like Nelson Rockefeller tried to run the domestic council. They tried to get some part of the government to run. Mondale said that the one thing he didn't want to do was to take on any line responsibilities. He simply wanted to be a general across the board presidential advisor and to take on important troubleshooting roles that President Carter wanted him to have, and that he wanted to have the resources to succeed in that role. And President Carter really agreed with that vision of the office, gave Mondale the resources that Mondale requested, and even gave Mondale a few resources that Mondale hadn't requested, which turned out to be very important. And, you know, in a sense, the rest, as they say, is history. They created a new model of the vice presidency, which made the vice president part of the president's inner circle. And it's really been followed by the next five administrations, three Republican, two Democratic, in different ways, but they've all followed the basic contours of what I've called the White House vice presidency.
Well, it takes two to tango, and it's, I guess, to Carter's credit as well as Mondale's, that the two of them both agreed that this is the way they were going to run that administration.
Absolutely. I mean, it would not have happened without President Carter. If he hadn't been committed to it, if he hadn't selected somebody in Mondale who had the qualifications and the skills that were needed to be successful as a vice president, if he hadn't been open to the vision and then absolutely committed, I mean, he really fulfilled all of the commitments he had made to Vice President Mondale throughout their term. And it's really sort of touching that 36 years or so after they've left office, the two of them, as they're both in or nearing their 90s, have remained very close and have established the relationship that they established back in 1976 continues 40 years later.
What I find is remarkable about that relationship is obviously Mondale wanted to be president because he ran for it eventually, but he did not let that get in the way of the relationship with Carter or, you know, confuse that relationship in any way.
Well, I think that's an important point. I mean, Mondale accepted the fact that Carter, not he, was president, and Mondale, his focus on creating the vision was how could he contribute to Carter's administration. He gave advice. He gave advice on substance and on politics that oftentimes was very critical of President Carter. But he then worked hard to implement President Carter's decisions and to make his administration successful. And interestingly, the same sort of pattern developed with George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. I mean, Mr. Bush had run against Governor Reagan for the 1980 nomination, had called his economic policies voodoo economics, and yet once he was selected, he worked very hard at establishing a relationship with President Reagan, and they did establish a very strong relationship. And I think we see the same sort of development with President Obama and Vice President Biden, where the two had run against each other. And yet, Vice President Biden, notwithstanding the fact that he'd served, nine times longer in the Senate than President Obama had, really has subordinated himself to the president and worked hard to implement his programs.
I want to pick up on that point, but I have to take a break. I'm speaking with Joel Goldstein, author of The White House Vice Presidency, The Path to Significance from Mondale to Biden. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation about the vice presidency with Joel Goldstein. Joel, you mentioned Vice President Biden, and I just wanted to point out that symbolic of the kind of relationship they have and the kind of relationships you're talking about is the fact when President Obama went to Orlando recently, he took Joe Biden with him. Not all presidents in our history might have done something like that.
Well, no, I think that's right. I think they've really established a close relationship that is, I think, personal as well as professional. And actually having the personal relationship helps solidify the professional relationship. But I think that's a symbol of the closeness, the eulogy that the president gave at Bo Biden's funeral is another example. The fact that when some of the White House aides were very critical of Vice President Biden when he really came out in support of same-sex marriage before the president had done so, the president wasn't bothered by that at all and was understanding. So I think they've had a very good relationship, and it's been part of the reason why Vice President Biden's been able to be as helpful to the president as he has been. I mean, the president's used him on things like it was Vice President Biden who negotiated the various budget deals with Senator McConnell that were important to the administration. No other president has allowed his vice president to be in the position of really being the closer on those deals in the way that President Obama has.
As you point out in the book, President Obama was even willing to put up with Biden's famous gaffes in order to have this relationship and flourish the way it has.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that in part, I think that's a function of the fact that Vice President Biden has worked very hard to minimize his gaffes, and I think really has. And then going the other way, I think the president and the people around him came to appreciate the fact that what they were getting from Biden was more than what the gaffes were costing. And one of the indications of that was in the 2012 election, when after the president had his poor debate performance against Governor Romney in the first debate, it was really the Biden debate that really sort of turned the tables and regain momentum for the Democratic ticket. So I think they've appreciated Biden, notwithstanding those faults.
Reflective again of the standard that was set by Mondale Carter. One of the things in your book that surprised me, which I guess just shows my lack of knowledge about the era, was you put Dan Quayle very high on the list of successful vice presidents. I would not have guessed that because he was considered, it seemed to me, during that era as something of a lightweight. But you say no, not at all.
Well, you know, Don, it was a surprise to me. When I started the research, I thought that the vice presidency had really, that Mondale was unique and then it had sort of skipped to Gore and Cheney. But as I looked at the Bush and Quayle vice presidencies, I saw that they really pretty much followed the Mondale model, and they were very much involved. And then particularly as I looked at Vice President Quayle's experience, I saw that notwithstanding that sort of general public image, that in certain areas he'd made real contributions to the Bush administration as a political and legislative advisor and operative. I mean, he was the person who was pushing President Bush to get a resolution of support from Congress before going forward with the Persian Gulf War. Chief of Staff John Sununu said that on any matter, legislative matters, that Quayle was the go-to guy when they needed to round up votes or when they needed advice. And so I think that that his role hasn't been fully appreciated. I think the last six vice presidents have been extraordinary figures. I wouldn't quarrel if somebody said that based on his career before and after the vice presidency, that Vice President Quayle wasn't as eminent as some of the others. But I think he really did serve ably as vice president and contributed to the Bush administration.
And all so much, so many people remember of him was his inability to spell potato. You know, I mean, that sticks with you for a long time, that kind of thing. Whether it should or not is certainly debatable.
It's really one of the unhappy aspects of our times is that sometimes of instances like that are what we remember about serious public figures and not what they contribute. And with the vice presidency, it's particularly vulnerable to that because so much of what a vice president does, and so much of how he or she is effective, is what they do behind the scenes. I mean, the surest way to lose your influence is to come out and say that the president was about to drive the country off the cliff, and then you walked into the Oval Office and saved the day. So much of what vice presidents do that makes a contribution, we don't hear about until perhaps after the administration, if at all.
You say in your book that the creation of the White House vice presidency, and we should clarify, I guess, if we haven't already, that what that really means is that the vice president has an office actually in the White House as opposed to across the street or someplace else, that he's in the House and very close to all the decision making. So that's what that's all about. But you say the creation of the White House vice presidency is the most impressive development in American political institutions in decades. That's quite a mouthful.
Well, I think it is the most impressive, and I think what's striking is that not only is that this office for most of our history was the most disparaged office in our government and our constitutional system, really didn't have much of a significant role for most of our history, but also the fact that the vice presidency has become a contributing ongoing office the last 40 years is significant because during the same period of time, we've lost confidence in many of our other institutions, the ability of Congress to function as it should, concerns about the presidency, about the method of electing, selecting presidential nominees and so forth. The vice presidency is the one sort of institution that really has had a very upward and positive trajectory, and I think that's rather significant and impressive.
On this subject, I want to bring in one of our listeners, Stevens, calling us from St. Louis. I think he has a question relative to this part of the conversation. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, I think the office of vice president is the most irrelevant subject that it could be. I mean, does anybody remember who were the in the face of a very effective, forceful president such as Andy Jackson, Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt? Does anybody remember who the first, during the first three presidencies of Franklin Roosevelt, who his vice president was, short of the fourth one, the last one? You know, I mean, Eisenhower, Nixon, they were all in effect. Because Nixon let Spiro Agnew dwindle in the wind until he went from one cow pot to the other, until he was finally resigned.
Stephen, I think we've got the point. Let's have Joel Goldstein respond to that.
Well, I mean, I think Stephen's point has a lot to it in the sense that for most of our history, the vice president's role was simply to preside over the Senate, and that was, I mean, John Adams said, "I'm nothing." That presiding over the Senate was really a non-job, and even in the period beginning with the vice presidency of Richard Nixon, when it moved into the executive branch, the vice presidency remained at the periphery. The vice president really wasn't involved in anything significant. But I think over the last 40 years, vice presidents have been in the room when presidents have made important decisions. They spend more time in the Oval Office and in the Situation Room than almost anybody else on the planet. And the ability to have that access to the president and to the other people at the highest positions of the government, the ability to be used to negotiate with the senior legislative leaders, to the senior leaders around the world, I think that has made the vice presidency the last 40 years, after the period that Stephen's talking about, a very robust and significant position.
Which is the whole point of your book, obviously, that period you cover are those last 40 years. One other area, Joel, I'd like to get to before we have to say goodbye is the issue of succession. You spent a lot of time in your book talking about that and the 25th Amendment, which provides for that. It's a little murky. I mean, this has come up a few times, and it's never been quite clear as to what should be done.
Well, there are a number of issues about presidential succession, and I think the 25th Amendment, which was ratified in 1967, made a great step forward. It provided a means for the first time to replace the vice presidency. Up until 1967, if the vice presidency was vacant, either because the vice president died or succeeded to the presidency, the vice presidency remained vacant through the rest of the term. And then Sections 3 and Section 4 of the 25th Amendment provided a means to deal with presidential inability. It's a very difficult problem as to what do you do when the president is disabled? How do you handle that? There have been a number of instances during the Reagan administration, during the second Bush administration, where the president had planned surgery and turned over power briefly to the vice president under Section 3 of the 25th Amendment. The more difficult problems deal with the situation where the president's unable to declare his or her disability or unwilling to, and then it provides that the vice president and the cabinet have the power to take action. And then there's a whole range of problems that remain. If there's no vice president, what happens if the vice president's disabled? There are a range of government continuity issues that haven't been addressed by law at this point.
Is this something that should be addressed in your way of thinking?
Absolutely. And I think it's really shocking that after 9/11, at a time when there was fear that one of the planes was headed for the Capitol building, I think it's unthinkable that Congress hasn't dealt with the problem of what to do if there was a tragedy that disabled or killed a big part of the House of Representatives. The only way to replace members of the House is by having special elections. There's no way of dealing with a disabled member of the House or a disabled member of the Senate. There's real problems in terms of if there was a disaster that wiped out a large part of the line of succession. I mean, at the State of the Union, there's always somebody who doesn't attend the State of the Union who's in the line of succession just in case there's an attack on the Capitol building during that time. But it's sort of comical that the person who's left behind is always somebody who's the Secretary of Agriculture or the Secretary of one of the positions that if he or she had to become president, they'd probably never talk to a general before, and they wouldn't be very well equipped to deal with the greatest national security crisis that the nation had ever dealt with. So there's a lot of issues that really ought to be dealt with in that whole area.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, Vice President Cheney removed himself some distance from Washington after 9/11 because of this very issue.
Well, he did, and to Cheney's credit, he took these issues very seriously. There was one of after 9/11, President Bush made a speech to Congress, and Vice President Cheney absented himself from that speech for exactly that reason. For periods of time, he worked at undisclosed locations. He was mocked for it, but it really was a reflection of his concern to preserve the line of continuity. And he even wrote a letter of resignation to President Bush in case he became incapacitated, because he realized that under existing laws, if the vice president's incapacitated, it creates grave problems in the provisions dealing with presidential inability. So I think he performed very well in these areas.
We only have a limited amount of time left. What kind of a grade do you give Cheney? He was vilified, obviously, by Democrats during that time, called a co-president and that sort of thing. What kind of a grade would you give him for his tenure?
Well, I think he was never really the co-president, but I think during his first term, he was extraordinarily influential, achieved a very high level of influence. I think towards the end of the first term, President Bush started to have some misgivings about him. And during the second term, while he was very much involved and he was still at the table, he didn't have near the influence that he's had that he'd had in the first term. So I think great influence in the first term, less in the second term. I think Biden's really been the vice president who's been able to sustain a high level of influence and engagement for two terms more than any other.
And finally, before we say goodbye, I have a question that's just popped up in front of me here. Do you watch programs like Veep and House of Cards? And if you do or don't, do you think that they have any kind of a real influence on the way Americans think about politics?
I've watched Veep some, and I'm sure that they have a influence. And I think in some ways, I think they capture some of the people who work in the White House, the ambition and so forth. I think one of the things that Veep misportrays is the people who work around vice presidents are really extraordinarily able, dedicated, impressive people, and they're not the sort of the clownish personalities that that are portrayed in Veep. But I've enjoyed the show.
Well, we've enjoyed our conversation with you, Joel Goldstein. It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us. And again, we'll tell folks the name of that book, which is a fascinating read, Great Modern History. The author is the book is The White House Vice Presidency, The Path to Significance from Mondale to Biden. Thank you, Joel Goldstein. Great to talk to you.
Don, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.